This download is made possible by all the generous folks who support public radio. If that includes you, thank you. If not, become a contributing member to your local station. And now, here's the show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I love thinking about this kind of thing. The war is over. What now? You've been freed from slavery, a lifetime of slavery. Now what? A nuclear deal with Iran gets signed. What do we do now? Diplomatic relations? Trade with Tehran? Looking down the road this hour, and looking at some special moments that mark endings and beginnings, Indian Nobel Prize winner Kailash Satyarthi talks about looking into a child's eyes the moment he is set free from a life of slave labor. It's a fascinating moment, a fascinating discussion, and it's an experience that he has had thousands and thousands of times. When a sniper in Iraq stopped shooting, what then? We're going to ponder the curious success of the movie American Sniper. When terrorists start shooting in France, do European Jews wonder if Europe's anti-Semitic history will suddenly repeat itself? We'll talk about that. And the post-war questions for the Middle East, that's where we begin this hour. The president offered the ending of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq as part of his positive legacy this week, and he noted the number of U.S. airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against ISIS as an argument that the U.S. is using its military power in a measured way to keep that conflict in check. But Ali Kaderi, chairman and chief executive of Dragoman Partners, who served as special assistant to five American ambassadors in Iraq and was with U.S. Central Command from 2003 to 2010, says the measure of U.S. accomplishment in the region is pitiful by his reckoning, and he says he wouldn't be surprised if it is Iran that soon claims mission impossible in a transformed Middle East.
We burned through $1 trillion during the Iraq War, 4,500 American dead, 35,000 wounded, and frankly walked away with nothing at the end of the day, largely because of a precipitous troop withdrawal and a lack of follow-through with diplomacy and ensuring that we had a viable partner on the ground in Iraq. Unfortunately, I think the president is now trying to largely ignore the Middle East, as demonstrated by his lack of focus on it in State of the Union. And I think that's going to continue to come back to haunt him as Libya implodes into a full-blown civil war. Same in Yemen, same in Syria, same in Iraq. And frankly, Afghanistan is teetering as well. Ignoring the cancer as it metastasizes is going to eventually lead to conditions resulting in another 9/11 potentially.
Do you think Iran has exploited this divided kind of chaotic silo situation that you describe in U.S. policy? And, you know, the president has spoken about the nuclear successes that the U.S. has had in negotiating with Iran. Does that forget about the fact that Iran's profile in destabilizing the Middle East has increased, almost since 9/11?
Absolutely. Obviously, Iran has been the primary beneficiaries of our invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, because by taking out the Taliban and Saddam Hussein, we eliminated Iran's two main rivals, the two regimes that were physically containing Iran on the Eastern Front and on the Western Front. So what's happened since 2001 and 2003 is the Iranians have spilled over the borders in Afghanistan. They've spilled over the borders in Iraq. They now have a direct land bridge through Iraq, Syria, and Lebanon to the Israeli border. And as we saw several days ago, the Israeli Defense Forces had to take action with a missile strike, and they ended up killing an Iranian general and several senior Hezbollah officers because they believed that those individuals were involved in planning a terrorist attack on Israel. So that's sort of a tactical example. What's happened strategically is Iran has now fully penetrated all elements of Iraqi society and government. They now have paid agents across political parties, senior members of the Iraqi cabinet, the military, cultural institutions, media, religious institutions. And frankly, I think, strategically speaking, we've now lost Iraq for at least decades, maybe a century or two, because the Iranians have so deeply penetrated that society. And that's problematic for a reason that nobody is yet focused on in the West. Think of Iraq as the next Lebanon, and think of the Iraqi militias as the next Hezbollah, in that Iraq is several times larger than Lebanon physically and demographically. And there are now dozens of militias that operate exactly like Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is one of the world's, again, leading terrorist organizations, which has blown up American embassies, which has helped kill U.S. troops, And after they deal with the Sunni insurgency, I am quite certain and terrified that the Iranian-backed militias are going to focus towards some of our regional allies, namely the Gulf Arab countries, in their desire to help pave the way for Iranian hegemony across the Middle East. With respect to the nuclear program, that's also very serious and something that the president glossed over during the State of the Union. The Iranians have been beavering away on a nuclear program for a couple of decades now. They say that it's for peaceful purposes, but if you had a peaceful nuclear energy program, you would do what the United Arab Emirates has done, which is bring in international investors, bring in international contractors, and build a reactor peacefully, very transparently. What the Iranians have done instead is bury their program across a dozen different facilities, most of which have been covert. Their tactical successes across Iraq and Syria and Lebanon have only emboldened them further, and they view the president's numerous letters to the Iranian supreme leader or his recent outreach to Cuba as signs of weakness. That's how Iranians view it. And so I think they feel quite emboldened to press forward further. And in fact, the Iranian supreme leader announced over the summer that the Iranians are developing a ballistic missile program, which will have intercontinental ballistic missile capability and potentially one day with nuclear warheads. So the situation is very, very dangerous. And I think, again, the administration is glossing over things. And one day we're going to wake up, as occurred with North Korea, and we're going to see a mushroom cloud on the horizon. That's not hyperbole. That's just the trajectory of the situation.
Would you say that Iran's influence in the militia in Iraq is a story that's being repeated now in Yemen?
Absolutely. I mean, the developments in Yemen for the past several years have been very disturbing. I visited Yemen to meet with President Ali Abdullah Saleh several times with General David Petraeus, General John Allen, and others from CENTCOM. And Yemen always struck us as much more dangerous than even Iraq because it's sort of another Afghanistan right there on the Arabian Peninsula, a few hundred kilometers away from Mecca, the holiest city in Islam. Yemen has 30 million people, is running out of water, is running out of oil, is sort of another Somalia, and thus it's been a major hotbed for al-Qaeda activity. In fact, several of the major terrorist attacks that were planned by al-Qaeda were either orchestrated or financed or otherwise organized by al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula based in Yemen. So Yemen is very dangerous. And what the Iranians have done there is, again, what they've done similarly to Iraq and Afghanistan. They've found a local proxy, the Houthi rebels, and they have been working with them for about 5 years now, spending billions of dollars to support them in their quest to take over the government. Well, they succeeded several months ago, and as of several days ago, they had overrun the presidential palace and basically are staging a coup, thereby threatening one of our top regional allies, Saudi Arabia. And I know many folks in your audience have no love lost for Saudi Arabia, but believe me, if you think the Saudis are bad, wait to see if something comes after them. It'll be much, much worse and a major threat to regional stability, global energy prices, and our own national security. Because we've seen in places like Yemen, Libya, Iraq, or Syria, or Afghanistan, if there is a vacuum, if a government falls, what always fills it is these transnational terrorist organizations and jihadi groups.
Ali Kaderi is chairman and chief executive of Dragoman Partners. He served as special assistant to 5 American ambassadors in Iraq and as senior advisor to 3 heads of the Central Command from 2003 to 2010. Ali, thanks so much.
Thank you.
The Obama administration's high-level nuclear negotiations with Iran are crowded enough, the president said this week. The White House doesn't want every member of Congress at the bargaining table, 535 more people. Some lawmakers might agree to punish Iran further for not agreeing to scrap its nuclear program immediately. And the president says he would veto any sanctions measure that threatens the talks. But members of Congress on both sides of the aisle aren't happy with the way the talks are going. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, joins me now. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So Congress is busy picking its battles with the White House for this term, and it appears this Iran battle is one that it's going to pick.
It's definitely going to pick this battle. It's already picking it, and it could be a showdown that leads to an override of a presidential veto. That is possible because both Republicans and Democrats want a say on this Iran nuclear deal and its aftermath, and they're putting the president on notice that if he vetoes a couple of efforts that could be coming out of the House and Senate here, he could be facing an override later this year. John, there's really two things going on. One is sort of what you mentioned. A lot of lawmakers want a say. They want to be able to vote, up or down, is this a good deal or a bad deal? Once not only the White House, but the international partners in the P5 plus one, the European Union and the UK and France and other countries make this deal. Now, that is supposed to happen by the end of June. The White House has already said that could again get delayed and go beyond the end of June. And a lot of lawmakers say they want to say in that deal. In addition, you have a lot of lawmakers, especially Republicans, but some Democrats, skeptical of the deal the White House thinks it might be getting. Obama says there's about a 50-50 chance of a deal now, but they don't like the deal at all. They think it doesn't have enough monitoring. It doesn't monitor Iran's uranium enriching and possible plutonium capabilities, its potential weaponized use of fissile material. And they don't like the deal, and they want to ratchet down on Iran to try to get a better deal. Listen to Senator Jim Risch. He's a Republican. This was yesterday in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
I appreciate what you guys are doing. Bless you. I hope you can pull it off. But I got to tell you, I thought from the beginning you were going to get scammed. And every day that goes by here, and as I listen to how these negotiations are going, I think you're getting scammed. And I hope I'm dead wrong.
So the Republicans, of course, believe that the Iranians are pulling a fast one here. Do the Democrats want more in the way of concessions on the part of Iran? Is there a difference between the way the Republicans and the Democrats are kind of splitting the hairs?
Yeah, there is, and a lot of members are all over the map here. It's kind of hard to assign partisan labels on this issue, which also makes it very, very interesting. But in matters of degree, the answer is yes. A lot of Republicans, John McCain is one, Risch is another one, want to have a situation that imposes tighter sanctions if a deal isn't reached by the end of June. That's it. Iran, you don't agree to a deal. We want to strengthen the United States' hand here. You don't agree to a deal. Tougher sanctions. The Democrats say what we want here is a regime that maybe ratchets down on sanctions or gives the option to do it if no deal is reached at all eventually. Now, the White House says they're skeptical of the Iranians, too, that they're on board with the concerns. They don't necessarily disagree. But Iran already has the incentives, John. Their economy is crippled. Their currency is down 16%. The reason they're at the deal is that the sanctions have worked. And the international partners are partners. If you ratchet down on sanctions, they'll bolt. And if the international partners, the rest of the world, bolts and starts doing business with Iran, the whole deal falls apart because the incentives are gone. So that it's not just the Iranians, but it's everyone else who's not doing business with Iran. Listen to Tony Blinken. He's the Deputy Secretary of State, one of the lead negotiators here. He was on the Hill yesterday.
And at the end of the day, we will all have to judge whether what we've achieved in any kind of solution meets our security interests. And we will not take a bad deal precisely because we share your concerns and share your suspicions.
Who thinks a deal is a deal on the Iranian nuclear talks? Todd Zwillick is Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thanks so much.
Pleasure, John.
This somber song speaks of a pogrom in the 1800s, a spontaneous and brutal riot against Jews in Europe. The experience eventually enveloped the lives of all Jews on the continent. Anti-Semitic oppression of Jews in Europe goes back to medieval times, but the explosions in the late 1800s, driven by economic hardship and a hatred born of poverty and ignorance, were at first considered isolated cases. But by the 1930s, they had become a mobilized campaign of extermination across Europe, conducted with the tacit complicity of Germans, Austrians, Poles, and Russians, among others. France was a special case, an oasis of liberty, partially because of its large Jewish population. But last year, more Jews left France for Israel than any other country. And 15,000 more French Jews are expected to emigrate to Israel in 2015, some of them possibly in reaction to the terrorist attacks in Paris earlier this month. Here's one Jewish emigre explaining why he's planning to leave, speaking on the German radio network Deutsche Welle.
There are clear historical parallels. These slogans scrawled on stores owned by Jews, we saw that back in the 1930s. One day we'll wake up here and see a new pogrom, a new night of broken glass. That could happen in France today.
That individual, Denis Blankemon, referring to Kristallnacht there in his discussions on Deutsche Welle. Rabbi Andrew Baker is Director of International Jewish Affairs at the American Jewish Committee. He also serves as a special envoy for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Rabbi, welcome to the program.
Nice to be here.
How vivid is this history of pogroms invoked by the attacks in Paris at the kosher supermarket this month?
Well, it was a shock, certainly, to see, for people here to experience. But I think what we're seeing in Paris, elsewhere in Europe today, is not necessarily a return of that lethal, genocidal anti-Semitism, but perhaps a return at least of the anxiety that Jews did feel in the 1930s. There are attacks, they're growing. There's a lower level of anti-Semitism that manifests itself in harassment and verbal and sometimes physical abuse on the streets. But there are differences too. Governments today are surely not what they were in the 1930s. So there's not a flood of exodus of Jews, but there are many more Jews that are wondering about their future or their children's future.
Do you think that terrorists can create a dynamic in Europe where Gentiles resent Jews living in communities in their midst when they become increasing targets of terrorists, that there's a kind of a tacit anti-Semitism, even if Gentiles in Europe aren't involved at all in any attacks?
Well, but I think what you've seen here in France is perhaps now the opposite. The attacks on Charlie Hebdo mobilized the society, and it may have made them more sensitive to the links that Jews see in, again, the attacks that took place 2 days later in the kosher supermarket. But there have been attacks prior to this, killing in the museum in Brussels last year by a French terrorist, and 2012 in a Jewish school in Toulouse, France. I think there's a recognition that they're linked. Jews are uncomfortable because they are targets here, but perhaps societies are now waking up. This is a danger for everyone.
Does it vary country to country, if we're talking Ukraine, Belarus, Italy, England, Belgium?
Well, surely it does. First of all, I think the presence of a radicalized Muslim group, these may be returning fighters from Iraq and Syria, or people that have become radicalized on the internet. They are largely, almost solely, people who are Muslims who've converted to Islam. They may be a very, very small percentage of the Muslim population in Europe, but that defines them, and you don't see this population in Eastern Europe. So those are differences. But even within Western Europe, now the question is going to be how governments stand up to this.
Has France unwittingly participated in this with its legislative efforts to control things like the Muslim hijab, which also underscores Orthodox Hasidic Jews who wear clothing that's very, very distinct and suggests a lack of assimilation?
Well, I think what you have in France is this strong tradition of secularism, which bans the displays of all these religious symbols in public. But the notion that somehow everyone is French and these community identities don't matter obviously is not the reality either. So how can you maintain this common tradition, but also get at the root causes to bring these communities back into a setting where there is tolerance and appreciation, even as we can recognize that there are differences? That's the challenge that the French government faces today in the long term. In the short term, they're addressing the question of security.
Rabbi Andrew Baker is Director of International Jewish Affairs at the American Jewish Committee. He also serves as a special envoy for the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
A moment that says freedom, that says you've made it, and the years of pain and sacrifice were worth it. This announcement has come to symbolize the world's universal acknowledgement of the value of a lifelong struggle like that, the Nobel Peace Prize.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided that the Nobel Peace Prize for 2014 is to be awarded to Kailash Satyarthi and Malala Yousafzai for their struggle against suppression of young people and children and children's right to education. Children must go to school not be financially exploited.
It was a moment of transformation for Pakistani schoolgirl activist Malala Yousafzai, fighting for the rights of young girls to be educated and to be safe from violence. Malala's transformation into an international symbol came after her near death for heroically standing up to the Taliban. The other winner in 2014 is Indian human rights activist Kailash Satyarthi, who in his 30 years of being an activist has probably seen more transformative moments than he has personally experienced. That moment, like no other, when enslaved children trapped for years beyond hope are abruptly freed from their servitude and ask their liberators, what now? Kailash Satyarthi has rescued tens of thousands of children from slavery, and he joins us from the studios of the BBC in Delhi. Kailash Satyarthi, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Can you tell me about that moment of liberation when children are freed and maybe had no expectation that they would be?
They could not comprehend the freedom on the first go because they have never seen, they have never experienced it. So it's a shock for them. But once they realize that they are free to be children again, they are free to go back to their parents, they are free to do whatever they like, it's so amazing experience. I would say it's divine experience to see the first smile of freedom on the face of a child and the tears roll down on his face of joy. I can witness a glimpse of God on that face.
What kinds of questions do children ask when they're in that moment and realizing that everything is about to change?
In many cases, they are traumatized. Sometimes when they are accompanied with the parents or we go along with the parents to free them, they are shocked because they were told that if your parents come to take you back, they would be killed. So sometimes some children refuse to recognize that they are our parents. It's quite difficult, but after some time they realize that they are truly freed, they are really going to be with the parents, then they start hugging them. And if we go to, say, liberate 10 children and suddenly we find them 50 children, they look at us and they want to be freed. So we have to free all of them. And then we have to make sure that they are safely repatriated back to their homes and reunited with their families and parents.
How much resilience do you see? How can children take these burdens into their adult life? Some of the scars are permanent, yes?
Definitely, because the childhood which is lost during those years could not be brought back. When I free them and try to convince them after consoling that you can go back to school, you can do whatever you like, you can play, many children ask, it is not possible because we are no more children. 12, 13 year old girls and boys say that they are no more children. But slowly we have to ease them and we have to tell them that they are still children and they can enjoy their childhood and life. This is the beginning when we free them.
What's it like for someone who lives in an environment where children are enslaved? It's hard for me to imagine day in and day out being that cruel.
Yeah, these people who enslaved them normally have a criminal mindset. And some of them have no idea about laws and guarantees, national or international provisions for the protection of children. A few of them still think, like those who keep children as domestic help, they think that they are doing some good for those children because if these children don't work with them, they will starve or they will be criminals, so better that they are working with us. And that becomes much more difficult when these people are well connected with the authorities and they are able to influence and bribe those authorities easily since they are earning huge amount of black money or illegal money. And that's why it makes them more criminal and more powerful.
What does it say to you when you've encountered people who clearly would be happy to kill you to keep you from doing what you're doing? You've had that experience.
Several times, actually. Many a times they took out the gun and put on my neck or head. Luckily, they did not shoot me because of one other reason. But of course, they have hit me and attacked me badly. I have my broken left leg. I have my broken right arm, my shoulder. I lost two of my friends. One was shot dead and one was beaten to death. So it's always risky. But I know that one has to pay the cost of freedom. One has to pay the price for it. If not me, then who? And whenever I free a child, I think that it's a small victory of liberty over slavery. And I think that I'm freeing myself by freeing a child, whatever dangerous it is.
What is it that makes for a fertile ground for child slavery? What enables it to happen?
It's most shameful that 5.5 million children are still working as slaves globally. And that's why we are asking the authorities and the international community to give the priority to it. Definitely, it's a combination of several factors, including abusing the and manipulating the poverty conditions, the illiteracy and ignorance of the parents. Then in some cases, in some countries, the social customaries, as well as social discrimination in the name of caste system and apartheid. So combination of several things. But the most challenging factor is the greediness of the employers, because if they can find the cheap or free laborers as children in mines or factories or farms, they can easily earn huge amount of money without paying anything to those children. Then the lack of political will and the widespread apathy towards the most neglected, the most ignored people of the society. And that becomes a mindset which continues this further, and the number of child slaves still remains same.
Kailash Satyarthi is the 2014 Nobel Peace Prize winner, children's rights activist, a prize he shares with Malala Yousafzai. Kailash Satyarthi, it's so great to talk to you, and our prayers and wishes that indeed your dreams, that should be the dreams of all of us, come true.
Thank you very much. I'm sure that this dream is going to come true in my lifetime.
If you want to hear an extended version of this conversation with Kailash Satyarthi, you can go to thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International, in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Three of the most memorable recent movies about America's experience in war have not been about winning or losing.
When I go home, people ask me, "Hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man?"
Black Hawk Down was about a small skirmish in Somalia that ended badly for American troops in an unresolved and forgotten war.
What's the best way to go about disarming one of these things?
The way you don't die, sir.
Hurt Locker was about a man's life trapped in the destiny of disarming deadly IED explosives in Iraq.
Hey, Mikey, I'm about ready to punch that time card. Do it.
Lone Survivor was about an ill-fated patrol in Afghanistan and a futile, pointless battle against the Taliban. The new Clint Eastwood film, American Sniper, was the surprise highest-grossing movie of the holiday weekend. The film stars Bradley Cooper and is based on the real story of U.S. Navy SEAL and elite sniper Chris Kyle.
Tell me why you do it.
Come on.
I want to understand.
Babe, I do it for you. You know that I do it to protect
you.
No,
you don't.
Yes, I do.
I'm here. Your family is here. Your children have no father.
You have to serve my country.
You don't know when to quit.
Sniper, distinct from the other films I mentioned, has had great success at the box office. The other films are download hits and very popular with Iraq and Afghanistan vets. Is there something about this Eastwood film, finding an American winner in Chris Kyle's story? Or is it timing? Americans are finally able to more deeply examine the consequences of the Iraq experience for the first time. Robert McKee is an award-winning author and lecturer on film. Robert, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello, John.
What do you think is going on with American Sniper? Some folks have tweeted that it represents a kind of closure for some veterans, and that's what the success is about. What do you think?
Well, I'm sure that's part of it. I know that there's was a tremendous curiosity in America to understand this war and try to understand what it was like to fight in this war, what the point of the war was. In the same way that many years ago, Apocalypse Now raised the same sort of big questions in America's mind about Vietnam, but it didn't answer them very well. This film, I think, does address those questions. But I think it's more than that. I mean, when people try to go back and figure out what's a hit and what's a miss and why, there's always some magic. I mean, there's always something that's really unexplainable in the kind of chemistry that connects between a film and an audience. And makes such an enormous difference.
What we experienced after Vietnam, I remember, was, you know, there was Apocalypse Now, which was a very much an anti-war film, it seemed. And then you had movies like Platoon, which was very much, and Rambo, which, you know, really ratcheted up a sense of the point of view of American soldiers. Will we see similar kinds of arguments, you know, distinct views of the war playing out on the screen as we get away from the Iraq and Afghanistan experiences?
It's possible. I mean, war is, I hate to say this, but a kind of gold mine for storytelling. The conflict is instantaneous. The morality has to be sorted out. And I think one of the reasons for the success of American Sniper is that it does try its best to somehow sort out the morality. I mean, in the past, the notion of being a sniper always had a negative connotation, no matter who was sniping. I mean, it's an ambush. It just always seems somehow unfair that the sniper cannot be seen and killing people who are in plain view and unaware. I mean, that always had a kind of unheroic connotation to it. To turn that into a positive is, in a sense, a one way, at least, to rationalize America in the Middle East. There's a lot of negative feelings throughout the country about our involvement from 9/11 on. And this film tries to sort the good from the evil, the right from the wrong, personalize it, and certainly dramatize it with tremendous effect. As a thriller, as a combat story, it raises your temperature with tremendous effect. I mean, it's extremely exciting.
Certainly there's something about the experience of seeing the film that is moving people. And I'm wondering if the metaphor of Americans being in a kind of sniper's perch, civilians back home in the United States, you know, projecting American power into the Middle East is a deliberate metaphor on Clint Eastwood's part. And what about PTSD? It seems like this movie makes PTSD a much more mainstream experience for the millions of soldiers coming back.
Yes, and of course, all of these films, by the way, are all biopics. Hurt Locker, Lone Survivor, Black Hawk Down, they're all about, you know, real guys. And in this story, this poor protagonist manages to overcome all of that terrible stress and disruption of war only to be killed by somebody who could not. And the irony of that is pretty grim. So there is some positive, certainly, sense of a guy surviving the war and coming home in this film, but it's ironized repeatedly. And so I can't feel that people felt a particular uplift from this film, but I think it did help satisfy, answer some questions. Also, I think, by the way, there's another possible explanation for the success. The marketing of this film was brilliant. Starting with the title, American Sniper. Hurt Locker is a phrase from military jargon that people would know, and they'd have to wait to see the TV ads to understand that it's a war film. Same thing, Lone Survivor could have been a story about somebody on a desert island. And again, you needed clips to see that it was actually a combat story. Fury was another one. This set in World War II, that was the title's ambiguous. But American Sniper, I mean, when you go to see that film, you know exactly what you're going to see. And consequently, that kind of clarity of marketing sets an audience up to sit down and get into exactly what it's about. And so the marketing was excellent. And titling films is an often overlooked art. I mean, it really takes great thought.
It's interesting because, you know, Clint Eastwood appears to have defied the conventional wisdom and decided not to hide the identity of this movie as some of these others did, which does make this a moment in time that's right to say, hey, this is a war movie and audiences are going to respond. Robert McKee, thanks so much.
You're quite welcome, John. Thank you.
Robert McKee is an award-winning author and lecturer on the art of film. What do you think the effect of Hollywood has on your impression of war? Austin, Texas, I think it glorifies war and has for a long time. I enlisted after seeing Platoon back in 1987.
Stephen Denton, Texas. I'm a veteran with a BA degree in tech theater. Hollywood doesn't shape my impression of war, just like Oscar the Grouch doesn't shape my impression of what a trash can is.
Laurie Williams from Austin, Texas. To me, rather than glorifying war, American Sniper showed the brotherhood of soldiers, the difficulties they have both in the war zone and returning home, and the power of love and caring to help bring returning soldiers peace. Also, as I am currently working with refugees from Afghanistan, this movie brought to light how scary it is for the locals who work with our soldiers.
Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Catch up on anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country. Support for The Takeaway comes from TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.